after that 5 or 6 year mission, they deorbited that and burnt it up in the planet Jupiter. Another mission they covered was Cassini. So quite a few of them. Cassini's now in orbit around Saturn, bringing back a lot of good information, especially about the planet, correction, moon Enceladus, 300 diameter mile moon, which has like basically snow on board. Let me drop it. Planet Carolyn Porco was there. She was the expert involved with the Cassini mission. And she's been on many times, NOVA-type shows. Originally, I believe she comes out of the Bronx. I know she comes out of the city, New York. And she's a lead investigator on the Cassini mission. And talked everybody through the possibility that Enceladus has heat inside the moon caused from the gravitational pull of Saturn being slightly irregular. Course of a couple of the other moons, stretching and contracting that moon, creating heat inside and creating water geysers going, you know, hundreds of miles in space, coming back as snow on the planet, on the moon. So you might be able to pick up that snow and bring it home and analyze that. Let me drop it. You never know, there might be a microbe in there. And that's what this whole movie is, two-part documentary is really bringing out. They even covered a little bit about the James Webb Space Telescope, the Hayabusa spacecraft by Japan that it was a touch-and-go type of landing on an asteroid, and it brought back very, very fine particles, not many, but enough to analyze. I read the results on that. Basically, they're similar to what you would see in a meteor. So, talked about that. They talked about Kepler. So, pretty good. Even a little bit about the Herschel Space Observatory. We dropped that. To end. So, one step beyond all of that, I just wanted to talk about the Herschel Observatory. That's the one in the L2 Lagrange position, not really orbiting the Earth. Actually, it is orbiting the Earth every 365 days, so it just sits in one spot of 1 million miles out from the Earth, along with its partner, the Planck Observatory. Those two were launched at the same time on the same rocket from an Agena, Ariane 5 rocket from French Guiana many years ago, and that's doing good work. That Herschel one is the one. It's got a pretty big diameter mirror. It's an infrared mirror, 3.5 meters in diameter, to give you an idea. Hubble is a little smaller, 2.25 meters in diameter. Of course, compare that to the James Webb. Forget it. Both of them are small. I mean, James Webb is twice the size of Herschel, and that's going to be infrared as well. So I want to bring that up, and that's pretty much it. Dick, I'll be back. Back to Ned. This is WS2N Space Report.
This weekend, there is a German-made satellite, a X-ray satellite that is believed to have re-entered the Earth's atmosphere. I think it was launched in the early 90s. I believe it ran out of life at around 1997, 1998, and it was at that time at a 300-mile elliptical orbit. The perigee was 300 miles, but it slowly has been descending, and I think it entered the atmosphere, hopefully in an inert spot. To your knowledge, Paul, and I've forgotten the name of the darn thing, this X-ray satellite, German-made, that they believe re-entered this weekend. Over to you, Paul.
That one pretty much made it to the ground, but I haven't read much on it. I do know about it. Don't know the name of it, and I've yet to research it. One quick piece they did have on the news on it that just happened. So we're looking for that. The other one that burnt up a while back, the USRA, that one was pretty much completely burnt up over the Pacific. I guess this one's in it there as well. When they burn up, you got mostly water here, like three quarters water, one quarter land. So you got a 75% chance of not hitting land. I guess this one didn't do that. I mean, there's been quite a few satellites that hit the ground. Cosmos, there was a Cosmos one by Russia landed in Canada, had some radioactivity on board. And of course, we all remember Skylab winding up in a brush of Australia. So I'll have to, we'll look into this, Dick. We're not up on contemporary things that happen right away, Dick. We'll review it and we'll bring it up on the net maybe next week, back to net.
Quick comment, Dick.
Very fine, John. The X-ray satellite, the German-made X-ray satellite, they were concerned about the fact that its main mirror is something like 3,700 pounds of metal, and they're fairly sure it will survive the reentry. So we'd rather not be hit with that one, and let's hope it did land in the water. And they're fairly sure that it's got a high inclination orbit, and therefore it probably hit a water area or a very very low inhabited area. KC2WGB, K2RAW, go ahead, John.
282SAY, comment.
Very good, Dick. I believe it landed in Asia. That's what the Scientific American news update was when I read it last. They thought it was going to land in water, but they believe it went to Asia.
Yeah, Doug recognized. Whereabouts in Asia? Do you happen to know? John, go ahead.
No, Dick, they just said the Asian continent. They didn't know exactly where yet, but there may be an update now. This was earlier today. I'll have to check that.
Okay, good information. And Doug, W-A-2-S-A-Y? My guess is you're coming through the eastern input of the machine, and you sound good. So go right ahead and tell us whatever you'd like. W-A-2-S-A-Y, K-2-R-I-W.
Okay, this is W-A-2-S-A-Y. Two things. First, the news that I saw says the satellite came down over Southeast Asia. I forget the name of the country, but it was like around Burma or something, or Vietnam, and it was going on an orbit northeast bound, and it, probably the last bits and pieces of it landed in southeast China, so that's where it went. The other comment I was going to bring up with all of the business about life in outer space, I wonder if folks on the net have heard of the Fermi paradox. You probably know what that is, Dick.
Yeah, the Fermi lab and also CERN, and we discussed this a little bit last week. Fermi lab didn't announce it because they didn't believe it, and then CERN saw it again, and they do believe it, and that is, in the case of CERN, they were launching neutrinos from the Large Hadron Collider. They were launching them in a direction where they go through the Earth and never enter the air, but come back out because of Earth curvature in the Rome area of Italy, something like 750 kilometers away. And they repeated the experiment over and over again, and they get something like 60 nanoseconds of lead time. In other words, the neutrinos, yes, they can usually go through the Earth without making one single encounter. And these particular neutrinos launched in Switzerland, come out in Italy, 750 kilometers away, and they come out 60 nanoseconds faster than the speed of light. That's got people really unhappy because they were positive that couldn't happen. And there's a timing error. And some people have reported that it's a misinterpretation of global positioning satellite data. I'm skeptical of that one. And now we're finding out that Fermilab saw the exact same speed up, and they had a different method of measurement. And they were afraid to announce it because they thought it must be an experimental error. Nothing can move faster than the speed of light. The percentage of increase is very small. But still, if it's real, does it mean we're on our way to going to warp 3 speed? I wonder if that's the one you're talking about, Doug. I wonder if you got any further information on this one. As I said, we live in exciting times, and investigating what's really going on here is going to be fun type stuff. WA2SAY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Dick, that's not exactly what I had in mind. there is something called the Fermi Paradox, which says, more or less, that we know, or we believe at least, that there are millions of planets out there, many of which are inhabited, and some of which probably should have attained a reasonable degree of civilization. How come we haven't heard any of them? That's the Fermi Paradox. How come we haven't heard from anybody in this whole universe?
There is a guess as to that one, Doug. Okay, that particular Fermi Paradox about why haven't we been contacted by extraterrestrial intelligence. We've been humbled to Don many times about starting off in the early days thinking the Earth is the center of the universe. We found out it wasn't the Earth. It wasn't our sun. It wasn't our solar system. It wasn't our galaxy. It wasn't our galactic group. It wasn't our universe, and so on. In other words, we've got a nice planet, nice sun, nice solar system, nice galaxy, and so on, but we haven't been favored in any way. That leads me to believe there's a lot of life out there. Of all the life that's out there, I'm convinced that half of it is ahead of us and half of it is behind us in technological progress. There are thousands and millions of places where life has probably formed. Most likely that life has, some of it has advanced because they had a billion years head start on us, so they've gotten pretty fast, pretty advanced. Interstellar travel, they've probably accomplished it. And there is something called the Prime Directive that was science fiction, but there's some real merit behind that particular science fiction. The Prime Directive, let me drop. The science fiction Prime Directive is that when you encounter another society that is far removed from yours in technological progress, you don't announce your presence. Because in the process of announcing your presence, there is the possibility, a strong possibility, you will destabilize them. They're going through that stage of their development where they think they're the best thing around, and they're the first and the best. And if they suddenly find out that they're way behind, does that mean they're going to start worshiping the more advanced society as a deity? Are they going to start a war because of it? You might destabilize them. And you might also be contaminating the experiment, so to speak. Leave them alone. So there's strong evidence that that advanced societies would possibly make a concerted effort to not announce their presence. There's nothing for them to be gained by it. And there's too many political problems you can create in the process of announcing your presence and trying to help one society more than another because you think one is more moral than the other. And the word morality is a very relativistic word. We want to believe that our particular country is more moral than some other country. Well, there's some exceptions to that. We've done a couple of amoral things, if you know what I mean. So maybe that's what you're referring to. There have been enough people who have seen things in the sky that are very difficult to explain. My family is one of those. And so I'm convinced that we're not alone, and I'm convinced that we probably haven't been contacted. But that's a bunch of opinions. So B2SAY for some further comments on extraterrestrial intelligence, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, okay. Well, I've of course heard of the Prime Directive. I'm an old Star Trekker myself. But it seems rather unlikely that every planet in the universe is practicing this Prime Directive. We haven't, after all, and we have transmitted RF energy into space that other civilizations could detect or will be able to detect when it gets there. And we have no reason to believe that other planets haven't gone through some kind of development like ours. And so therefore, if they have, why haven't we detected the RF energy coming off of their radars or their Saturday Night Live or whatever? WA2SAY, back to that.
They were using subspace.
You could say, Doug, that we as a society, in our technological progress, have only in the last few years approached the point where we have radio telescopes sensitive enough to possibly start seeing the emission of other solar systems, of other star system planets. We just barely reached that capability by way of the Green Bank Telescope at the National Radio Astronomy Observatory, or some of these other things. In other words, we haven't had the capability for very long. We haven't done very much of a search. And the fact that we haven't discovered anything yet, you got to be careful how you interpret that. It's to prove a negative is very difficult. You can't prove that there never was a pink elephant unless you find one, if you know what I mean. So, and what's the advantage of announcing your presence? Are they really going to exert tremendous amounts of their energy to announce their presence? Also, there's lots of science fiction. Let me drop.
UKEY.
Mel recognized there's lots of science fiction where some alien society comes here and does us harm, captures our resources that they consider valuable and whatever, and I'd like to believe that an advanced society that didn't blow themselves up has adapted some morality where they respect all life. And if they didn't respect all life, they would have destroyed each other, so to speak. On top of that, so that's one reason why they wouldn't do harm to another society far away. Second of all, even if we had the most valuable stuff, it has no value to them. The example that I've used in the past is that choose whatever substance you think is the most valuable thing in the world, diamonds, platinum, gold, whatever. Assume the moon is made of it, and you're going to go there and get it. When you look at the resources required to simply go to the moon, pick up the stuff, and bring it back, means that it's going to be the most expensive stuff in the world. You're much better off molecule by molecule creating it in your particle accelerator here on the Earth. I'm exaggerating, but you know what I mean. So to go to some other star system to capture whatever they've got that you think is valuable, I doubt it. K2KEY, K2RIW, go ahead, Mel.
WA2RYY checking in. I'd like to ask you a question, something related to this in a little way, in a roundabout way.
Very fine, Joe, but Mel first. Go ahead, Mel.
Yeah, we did receive a signal. At my old school, we did receive a signal from space called the WOW signal. And according to, at that time, Mr. Jay Kraut, it definitely came from someplace out there. That was no way that they could have pulled off this hoax, Dick, over.
Yeah, what Mel was referring to is the very large radio telescope that used to exist in Miamisburg, Ohio, I think is the name of the town. The Wesleyan outpost of Ohio University. Wesleyan is the name of the word that sounds religious, and you and I couldn't think of yesterday, Mel. So the Wesleyan Observatory at Ohio University was this, let me think, what was it now, 100 foot wide, was it 100 or 150 foot wide reflector going into a great big parabolic surface, going into a pair of feed horns. And the way that L-band radio telescope worked, it worked at roughly 1400 megacycles, was one of the main frequencies, is that there were two horns side by side, and the telescope did not, you could steer it in elevation, but you could not steer it in azimuth. The azimuth, which the radio telescope people call it right ascension and declination. You could steer it in declination, which means you could steer it to higher and lower latitudes. But the longitude of the telescope was steered by the Earth rotation, 15 degrees per hour. And by the two feed horns side by side, if you had a real intercept in space at a far distance, there's a given length of time, I forget what it was, 3 minutes, 5 minutes, whatever it is, the signal that swipes through the first horn, some number of minutes later, that exact same signal is going to go through the second horn. And this huge signal was received exactly on those two horns with exactly the right timing, which says it was an extraterrestrial, very strong radio source of some kind. And it hasn't been repeated. And because of the way the signal was recorded on the strip chart recorder, it's really a digital readout, which you can make into a strip chart recording. When that was first discovered and somebody was reviewing the data a day or two later, He wrote alongside of it WOW. Wow. It was a signal that was, 80 dB above threshold, some huge number. And depending on whether you hold the chart right side up or upside down, it's either the WOW signal or the MOM signal, but a huge signal. And so that exact position in space has been visited many times, and that signal wasn't there again. Was it a supernova that lasted just for that particular Earth rotation? And unfortunately, because the data wasn't read soon enough, in other words, it was some number of days later where the data was discovered. Had it been discovered that particular night, just like the movie Contact with, can't think of the girl's name now, the actress who was in that movie.
Jodie Foster.
Too bad Jodie Foster wasn't listening at that time and said, hey, we've discovered something. Let's listen to it on the very next revolution. Well, some number of days or weeks later, they finally discovered this, went back to that location, and there was no longer nothing there. So was that extraterrestrial signal strength that was being read is a darn interesting question. Was it really a coherent signal? Was it just a huge burst of noise of a particular supernova going on? Lots and lots of questions that haven't been answered. Unfortunately, that particular radio telescope lost its funding, got torn down, and the land got resold, and I think it became a golf course. And it's got a lot of people very unhappy. Thank goodness the great big radio telescope at Greenbank, the 300-foot, 100-meter-wide, fully steerable radio telescope, is quite a bit higher in performance, so you could say it's going to take over. That's the good news. The bad news is because such a long list of people who want to use it that to get time on that one is not going to be easy. Joe, you wanted to make a comment on this. From A2RYY, haven't heard from you in a while, Joe. K2RYW on the TechNet.
Well, it's not a comment directly to the subject, but it has to do with it, so I don't know how you want to proceed with this. You want to just put me on the list or whatever. I mean, my personal belief is we're not the only ones out there. There's got to be something else out there of the trillions of things we can see just with telescopes in this location called Earth. There's got to be something else out there. But I have another question related to this.
Since we're on extraterrestrial intelligence, the search for life and whatever, it's a wide enough subject, I guarantee you can ask your question. Go ahead, Joe.
Okay. It's a question actually in a couple of parts, but they're all related to each other. And it's just something I had just curious about. Absolute zero, as far as temperature, is the cessation of all heat, or the cessation of all heat and molecular movement. Answer that first, and then I'll ask the next part of it.
Temperature is something we all measure with an instrument we call a thermometer. And a hell of a lot of people say, if you ask them, what does a thermometer do? Well, it measures hot and cold. Man, that's overly simplistic. What you and I call temperature, the air in your room right now is 70 degrees Fahrenheit, roughly 23 degrees centigrade. The word temperature represents a certain amount of velocity, which represents a certain amount of thermokinetic energy of the molecules that are being measured with that thermometer. So as you go to one-half the degrees absolute, degrees Kelvin, which they now call Kelvins. Right now, you and I are sitting at something like 290 Kelvins. If I go to 145 Kelvins, exactly half of the temperature on the absolute scale, then all of the kinetic energy of all of those molecules will be exactly half, which is like 70% of the velocity and so on. So when you go down to absolute zero, which is not approachable, you can get closer and closer to it, and they've gotten down to micro degrees of it, but they've never really got there. In theory, all kinetic energy of the molecules has gone to zero, therefore all motion of those molecules has gone to zero. But it's something that you can approach, but can never really get there, because the outside universe is always pouring heat, so to speak, into your experiment. So can you ever get absolutely perfect insulation and absolute perfect refrigeration? The answer is no. You can get closer and closer to it. You can approach it asymptotically. You never really get there. But now, I think I anticipate a little bit about what you're asking, and that is, how in the world can you get superconductivity at cryogenic temperatures? How in the world is the conductivity, the resistance of the moving...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Not quite what I was going to ask you.
Okay, go ahead with your next question, Joe.
Okay. See, taking just what you just said into consideration, okay, I don't know the exact figure, but now you sent this the spacecraft like Voyager, that's like, what is it, 1 billion miles away, 2 billion miles, something way, way past Pluto. So it's very, very far away from the sun. I'm sure the temperature out there is very, very cold. How does this thing keep on performing and doing its thing as far as the electronics on it are concerned? Is this something that keeps it thermally insulated and warm within itself? Because I don't know if the electronics would be able to actually work at those kind of temperatures. Back to you, Dick.
Okay. What Penzias and Wilson measured in 1968 and got the Nobel Prize for it at the Holmdel Bell Laboratories, they took their hoghorn-shaped radio telescope, aimed it in every direction in the sky, and looked at what was the sky temperature. They rapidly came to the conclusion that the sky temperature is 2.73 degrees Kelvin. In other words, because Big Bang made a hell of a lot of a heat velocity experiment 13.7 billion years ago, and the hold-on thing that you and I call our universe, and I'm not convinced it's the only one, our particular universe has been spreading out, expanding, and cooling off. And you go through all the correct mathematics, you will predict that as it's cooled off, here we are 13.7 billion years downrange, we're down to 2.73 degrees Kelvin. A very good cryogenic refrigerator these days can get to that temperature extremely easily and way, way colder than that. So your Voyagers out there way beyond Pluto are in the area of the free space that's 2.73 degrees Kelvin, nowhere near absolute zero. On top of that, because...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Because they knew Voyager was going to go so far out that solar cells would be useless, it has a nuclear power supply on board. That nuclear power supply is what runs that 10-watt traveling wave tube transmitter that allows it to send back information, and it's still talking to us. And by the way, I think at the speed of light, it's so far away that the signal takes 8 hours one way to get from there to here. So it's got a nuclear power supply that's creating...
Trip, Dick.
What was that again?
32 hours round trip.
32 hours round trip. All right. I thought it was 8 hours one way. That would be 16 hours round trip. I'll accept.
It's 116 AU.
Okay, we'll soon figure that out. One astronomical unit gives you 8 minutes of delay from the sun to the earth at the speed of light, and you say 168 times 8 minutes, we can easily figure out what that is. It's a significant number of hours for the communication to take place one way. And that nuclear power supply is creating heat, which in turn goes to a thermal electric generator, which converts the heat back into electricity that runs the electronics on board. So it's got a local heat source that's good for some ridiculous number of years. That's how it's being powered, that's how it's being heated, and the electronics is probably close to that power supply heat, if you know what I mean, and therefore not being overly cooled. And when it comes to a low noise front end of a receiver, a microwave receiver, being cryogenically cooled helps. It allows the noise figure to be lower, allows it to be more sensitive. Over to you, Joe, the B2RYY, K2RYW on the TechNet.
Okay, very good. So the thermal blanketing that this thing is built within, is that good, even with the internal heat source, to keep that kind of cold differential between, say, something approaching, 450 degrees below zero to something, you know, tolerable inside to keep the electronics? That's amazing. They can keep that kind of differential between the inside and the outside. So it's all a matter of the energy. When the energy source goes, it's gone. Okay, back to you.
They got the thermocouples. Dick, tell them about the thermocouples. That gives them the power, and then the power goes to the batteries, and the batteries go to the heat.
Yeah, the thermal electric generator. I can't think of any the abbreviation, the acronym that was used for that thing, developed by Ames Research, I think it was, that powers Voyager 1 and Voyager 2. Very crafty power supplies. I think the one that's...
I think either isotopic generated, Dick.
What was that full abbreviation? Give us a little bit of a delay before you answer. Go ahead.
Isotope generator. That's what it says. It heats up the blanket. The blanket's got the thermocouples in it, a million of them in series and parallel, and that generates the power, and then they power up the batteries, and these things power up the heaters, and it keeps itself warm and runs the whole thing, and you wind up with your, I guess, 20 watts going back there.
Now, wasn't there a great big flap when either Galileo or Cassini were launched, because they also have nuclear-powered generators on board, because when you're at Galileo was at Jupiter and Cassini is at Saturn, in both cases you're so far away that solar cells are very ineffective for the number of watts they want. So I think there were a number of environmental people reasonably unhappy before those launches took place for fear that if the launch failed, a lot of nuclear energy, nuclear material would be dumped on the Earth, even though it was put into an extremely safe container. So I believe both Galileo and Cassini are nuclear powered. Is that true, Paul? Go ahead.
They are, and the protesting didn't start until around Galileo's launch. And meanwhile, you know, they've been doing that since, well, actually, the Apollo 12 mission had plutonium on board. 11 didn't. Your Pioneer spacecraft, which are now out of the solar system, they had it. The Ulysses spacecraft in polar orbit around the sun, that has it, or had it, and they shut that mission down. Galileo had it, of course. Many spacecraft have flown with plutonium on board. And, they're starting to get, you know, they're getting away from it now, you know. But you still need it. New Horizon has it going out to Pluto. Real deep space missions have to have that. And there was a big thing about it. But I've seen demonstrations of these canisters, I mean, being blasted. You can't break these things open. It's unbreakable. I mean, you wouldn't believe the test. I couldn't believe it. The power that they hit these canisters with, and nothing happened to the thing back here.
I heard somebody try to sign in, but an extremely distorted signal. Don't know if we're going to be able to pull you out. But first, Paul, you said that the Apollo mission had nuclear power on board. Was that for the Apollo Lunar Surface Experimental Packages, the ALSEP packages that were left on the moon? Are those the ones that were nuclear powered, Paul? Go ahead.
So, yeah, nothing to do with the mission itself. All the missions left the equipment on board on the moon. 11 didn't have it. I think 11 had the, you know what they had? They had that mirror. That was great for the lasers. Bounced on the lasers off the moon. That's how we found out that the moon was moving away 1 centimeter every year from the Earth. But yeah, Apollo 12 started with it. And I mean, practically every major mission has had it since. Some missions like Juno, that's on the way to Jupiter right now. That has solar panels. That doesn't have it. But most of your big ones do. Back to you.
Yeah, I'm going to come back to you in a minute. I want to hear a little bit more about Juno. Somehow that one escaped me. The person who just tried to sign in, speak a little bit more softly so you're not distorted, and speak slowly. And I think I'll be able to figure out who you are. Go right ahead. K2RIW listening. Heavily distorted. Kilo Charlie 2 Mike Quebec something. Want to try that again? And what's your name, sir? Just barely. KC2 Mike Quebec Alpha. Start up with your name, sir, and then with earphones, I'll try to figure out what you're saying. Start up with your name and then your question. Go ahead.
Check his frequency first. He might be 5 KC up or down the repeater.
Yeah, if you're coming through the repeater, make sure that you're on 146.85 and not 855, if you know what I mean. But I think he's coming through an internet connection. Mike, Quebec Alpha. Start off with your name, sir, and then your question. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Okay, sorry. Try again. KC2FJ. Hang on, I'm supporting you. Okay.
He's on VHF directly.
Okay, you guys should give me fly now. You got me okay?
I think we're getting you, so go right ahead. Tell us your name, sir, and then your question.
Okay, let me start off. My name is Al. The call is Casey. I'm pretty interested in talking about. I heard the one station talking about plutonium. My question was, is the satellites / I don't know, probes, what you want to call them, are they powered by the plutonium?
Al, you've got some kind of a problem with your transmitter because your audio is there for 2 seconds, then it's gone for a second. There for 2 seconds, then gone for a second.
Go off the mic a lot.
Yeah, maybe if you back off on the mic a whole lot, you might be in there continuously. I can tell you're asking a question about the nuclear power supplies. Try again, Al. Back off on the mic a whole lot. Let's hope that the audio stays there.
Okay, I hear a breaking station. I'm backing off the mic. I haven't been on this particular radio in a long while. I do have a W2YHY EQ in line. I don't know if I'm have it set correctly or something on the wrong, but I seem to be on frequency correctly.
Okay, you backed off on the audio, and that time you stayed there the whole time, Al, so we heard everything. Go ahead and repeat your question. And Frank, BXO, we heard you. We'll pick you up right after Al. Go ahead, Al.
Okay, Dick, thank you. I was very interested in the other station speaking when you said plutonium. Now, my question was the plutonium being used as a fuel? You know, I guess it's being used as a fuel for either electricity. That was my question.
Yes, a properly designed nuclear power source made out of plutonium, for instance, continuously is emitting particles. Those particles get absorbed by some kind of a shield that's internally. The process of absorption creates heat. The heat operates thermocouples. The thermocouples convert the differential heat. There's hot on one side and the heat sink and cold on the other side. And the differential temperature across the thermocouples creates electrical energy. So the bottom line is that if you've got a plutonium-type power supply, you've got a reasonable amount of electrical power for the next 20 or 30 years. It doesn't require solar cells. So many of these deep space probes are all using polonium-like nuclear power supplies in order to supply the approximately kilowatt that some of these satellites need to run all their experiments, transmit the data back home, and so on. Because as you go beyond, well, let me pick a number. As you go beyond the orbit of Mars, you're so far away from the sun that you'd have to build solar arrays so darn big to power your electronics with solar voltaics that it's essentially out of the question. So all of your deep space probes look like they're going to be using nuclear power supplies. Let's see what Frank wants to add to all of this. To B2BXO, one of the key people of the Kings County Radio Club, K2RIW. You got it, Frank.
Yeah, very good. This is Jim Mellon from the U.S. Forces. I hear a little bit of the I remember correctly, I think the trade name on the nuclear generators used was for the Alpha experiment, which was NAP generators. What the NAP was back in the
Go ahead,
Dick.
Frank, between the first time you signed in and that time, you either moved or changed power. You're right at the threshold of 90% noise, 10% audio. So you're giving us an extremely weak signal. But I did manage to hear that you're saying that the nuclear power supply is called SNAP, S-N-A-P, and that sounds right. I remember hearing that. Don't know what the acronym stands for either, but these nuclear power supplies are very handy. I'm trying to remember now. I think, I'm going to ask Paul, did any of the Mars landing missions use nuclear, or every one of them using solar cells? And WS2N, K2RIW?
Okay, well, Pathfinder, they were solar operated. Pathfinder, you know, that was the lander. And then, I believe it did have, I think that did have one small piece of plutonium in it to keep the electronics warm in what they call the web, not the internet, not the internet web, but the web, W-E-B, warm electronic box. And I think its purpose was just to keep the electronics warm. So they did have a small piece of, in that. And then the Sojourner was the one that was riding around about the size of a microwave oven. And then since that landing, the Pathfinder, which is the one that is permanently sitting there, was officially renamed the Carl Sagan Memorial Station. You know, they gave him the name. Now, what happened after that, you have Spirit and Opportunity. Anybody that's seen that, it's nothing but solar cells, big body of solar cells, and big, I call them wings that folded out after it had landed, which had more solar cells on it. So that's 100% solar cells. Let me drop it. Phoenix, which landed 68 degrees north on a Martian planet, didn't have wheels. That stayed there. It did not have solar. Didn't have plutonium. That had solar cells, but big round ones. And that lasted for what, 3-4 months, and then the winter kicked in, and that was the end of that mission. They knew that. The other Mars landers, a couple of Mars landers that failed, don't believe they had it. The one that's going now, Curiosity, you'll look at the back of that, you'll see no solar cells. That is 100% plutonium. Let's hope that thing rides around for many, many years, Dick. That's a plutonium job. I hope the protesters don't come out for that. Back to you, Dick.
And when it comes to warming up the electronics on even the ones that do have solar cells, and they have to go through the Martian winter where the temperatures go down to some crazy number like minus 150 centigrade, I think it's the batteries are the main thing that cannot tolerate those temperatures. So when you have a warm electronic box, a web that's nuclear powered, I am guessing the main thing that has to be kept warm is the battery. The electronics, your gallium arsenide and your silicon transistors, they work very nicely when they're cold. In fact, they like cold better than hot. So I'm guessing it's only the batteries that require heating in the warm electronic box. Does that sound approximately right, Paul? Go ahead.
That's right, 100% right. They had problems designing that, you know, and they realized that, you know, the wires, just the wires running into this box, was allowing too much heat to get in. You know, they get cold. So they devised a system where the box is like longer, and the box the wires would enter one end of the box, and there was all kinds of insulation involved. Just went through a whole big process. I remember reading about it in one of the books when they designed Pathfinder and the Sojourner. Good, excellent book, by the way. If I find that on my shelf, I'll let you know what that is there. And they talk all about the web and how that was all designed. Big deal on how to perfect that, engineering-wise. It's a good engineering book. And later on, maybe probably at the end of the night, or now, whatever you wanted to talk about, Juno, the spacecraft. Back to you there.
Yeah, before you tell me about Juno, and I want to hear that one, Spirit and Opportunity was a heroic effort headed up by at least one really enthusiastic guy named Steve Squires, an astro scientist from Cornell University. He put a lot of effort into Spirit and Opportunity, worried about all the fine details that could create failure. And when you and I saw this recent movie, the two-hour show on Nova this last week about looking for life, again, they interviewed Steve Squires, and he looks a little bit older. And I had the impression he's also heavily involved with Curiosity. Do you have reason to believe that he was heavily involved in the design and development of the Curiosity craft that's about to be launched toward Mars, the so-called Mars Science Laboratory? WS2N, K2LAW.
I don't know. I didn't think he was that much involved in that because, he was the lead on the other two rovers. There was an older fellow, I forgot his name. And they sent him over. He was in charge of Curiosity. He's probably still with them. So I don't know how much he's involved. Squires was his big thing was teaching in Cornell, upstate New York. He took over Carl Sagan's real job. Carl Sagan was a big-time teacher up in Cornell. And maybe he went back to that. I don't know what Squires was. I saw that, too. Yeah, that's kind of creepy when he's getting old. But a lot of these people on these long-duration missions, they purposely look for really young people because, as the years go by, New Horizon was launched years ago, and that's not going to get out to Pluto until, 2015, 16 or something. So, they're a lot older when the missions get to wherever they're going. Back to you, Dick.
WA1VGX. WA1, sounded like VGA, Victor Golf Alpha. You're going to have to repeat that one. A little bit of noise. And some of these missions, from the time they are planned, you have to fight for the funding, you get the funding, you do the research and development, you do the building, you do the launch, you wait for it to get there. Once it gets there, you start gathering the data, and now you're processing the data. There are people who spend their whole technical career, from the time they leave college until they retire, they can easily be on one single project. If you look at that whole chain of events. It's a lot of time on some of these really long-range projects. WA1VGA question mark, K2RIW. My name is Dick. Start up with your name and call letter, sir.
Hello, Dick. It's me, Harry, WA1VVH. Just want to say hello. Fascinating conversation, so I don't want to break it up, but just wanted to give you a hello.
Okay, that's Harry from Upper Massachusetts, or is it Lower New Hampshire? I keep forgetting. What's the rough number of miles? You and I have worked out the number of miles between your QTH and mine, Harry. Harry, by the way, if you go to Whiskey Alpha 1 Victor Hotel, you'll see a beautiful picture of what I think is a 150-foot high Rhone 55 tower top-down photograph. I wish you were standing on the tower also during that photograph. But you go to the QRZ.com. You go to QRZ.com, WA1VVH, you'll see a beautiful picture of his QTH. I think you're in northeastern Massachusetts. Is that true, Harry? Go ahead.
Yeah, we're in the state, a little bit southwest of Nashua.
And what's your best guess as to the number of miles between you and me? I guess QRZ.com will tell me, but maybe you remember.
As I recall, it was 170 and some change between you and me.
And so that makes it more like 180 or so miles to the repeater. You're transmitting how many watts into what kind of an antenna to get to the repeater right now, Harry? Because you're the best DX that we've heard here as far as direct over-the-air RF, with the exception of K4ABC. Over to you, Harry.
I don't recognize his call. He must have a good setup. Yeah. 100 watts into 24 elements to stack 12. Go ahead.
Okay, stacked 12s, vertically polarized mostly, 100 watts into them. And if I know you, it's fed with 7/8 inch Andrew Heliacs, probably almost 200 feet of it. Is that true, Harry?
You know, half right. It is a good 200 feet of the stuff, which I think is, yeah, just is about 200 feet, maybe in some small change, but it's half inch. Not that it matters a whole lot on this frequency.
I think you're telling me it's half inch hard line. Out of curiosity, is it 70 ohm half inch hard line or 50 ohm half inch hard line, Harry?
It's the Andrew LTF4, the 50 ohm stuff.
Hey, you sound good. You're dead full quieting to this machine now at something like 170 miles. Okay, glad you're enjoying this craziness. Anyone else with any further space-like questions or comments right now? Oh, wait a minute. Now, Paul's going to tell us about Juno. And Juno, I think you're saying, is on the way to Jupiter. And Galileo, I'm amazed that they had to crash Galileo into the surface just to make sure they don't contaminate the moons. So tell us about Juno, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW, when launched, what's it going to do?
Yeah, they're going to do the same thing with Cassini, too, when that's finished. Juno was launched a couple of months ago, I think it was, late July, early August, and it was delayed, probably early August, and it's going to go into a polar orbit when it gets there. You got to remember, it's all a long way out. Jupiter's 5 AU. AU being the astronomical unit of Earth to the Sun, so five times the distance between us and the Sun. So, give you an idea of telecommunication wise, 8 minutes to the Sun, so eight times that. If Jupiter is, you know, right near us, you know, if the orbit is, you know, in line, Sun, you know, Mercury, Venus, Earth, and then Jupiter. And if we're in line, we're around 4 AU away from Jupiter. So at the closest transmission-wise, it would be, you know, roughly a little longer than a half hour each way. And I think it's going to go into a polar orbit. Let me drop it.
On a quick break, you told me how many astronomical units to those two outer ones, Voyager. I think you said 130 astronomical units. Run that by again.
Look, a couple of months ago, I think it was 116 was one of them, and then the other one was a little shorter than that, so you're probably up to 120, I guess, now. I don't know. I think it's every year it's three AU that it goes out, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay.
So, you know, I think it's 116. You're going to do the math. But I think it's 32 round trip on Voyager Voyager 2. And Voyager 1 is a little shorter. It's closer in. Traveling away from the Sun at 40,000 miles per hour. I'll finish up on the Juno Jupiter mission. That is not a radioisotope generator, RIG mission. That is a solar panel mission. Big solar panels. I remember talking about it on the net a long time ago. I think it's longer than a house. Probably 60, 70 feet long. Two big panels. Drop it. And they're really big, I mean, compared to what you would have on an Earthbound mission. An inverse square law, you know, it's 1.6 AU to Mars, so call it twice the distance. So you need, like, just for last, four times the size of what you're going to have going around Earth to generate the same amount of power for their satellite. Into the solar orbit, polar orbit, and that thing will take all the pictures it needs to take to determine what's below the surface, actually. All kinds of instruments on board. And since it's going to cut it up like a pie, or like a, you know, maybe like an apple, going around in a polar orbit as the planet spins below it, it only needs 33 orbits to complete its mission. So after 33 orbits, that mission will be done, finished, to complete everything that it needs to do. So they're going to look at the winds, they're going to look at the moisture in the atmosphere, whether or not it has a rocky core or not, the exact mass, a whole bunch of things they're going to find out from Juno. Juno is not an acronym. It's WS2M. Out of the spacecraft. So that comes from, you know, all this mythology and all. And something to do with one of the gods and a veil or this. I was terrible at that anyway. So one of those mythology names, Juno. Back to that, WS2N.
Very fine. 116 astronomical units, and one astronomical unit is roughly 8 minutes of speed of light from the sun to the earth. That works out to be 15 and a half hours one way, 31 hours round trip, if it was 116. I think Pluto is something like 35 astronomical units, so
about 39 generally.
Okay, 39. So 39 astronomical units to Pluto, and here we are with Voyager 1 and 2 being something like 116 astronomical units. That makes it what? 2.5 times the distance to Pluto. Really out there. Whoa. Now, what in your best guess, Paul, is the reason why solar cells are on Juno as opposed to nuclear? Because it's only going to make a small number of orbits, and it's only going to look at Jupiter itself. It's not going to look at the moons. I mean, if it's in a polar orbit, and the moons are essentially going around Jupiter in a equatorial orbit, you're going to be encountering the moons at a very unfavorable, trajectory, so to speak. So I'm guessing that Juno is not going to be favoring moon observations. It's favoring only Jupiter measurements of what's below that atmosphere. So why in the world did they choose solar cells as opposed to nuclear? Your guess on that one, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Well, the technology is there now. That's what I remember reading in regard to this, and a couple of the other ones. For instance, the Hubble. If you look at the original Hubble Space Telescope, the panels are about one-third shorter now than they were. On one of the servicing missions, they shortened those panels, and the reason for it was not that they needed less electricity, but the technology advanced, and they're able to get one-third more of the power out of the new ones. So a few years back, European Space Agency launched a mission to the asteroids, and it's called Rosetta, and that should get to its destination, I think, around 2014. And that was launched a long time ago, I don't know, maybe 7 years ago. And Rosetta has got huge panels, big-time solar panels. So, same thing there. And so you could do that now, But if you're going to go out to the asteroid belt, is, in between Mars and Jupiter, so it's not too bad for Rosetta. But if you're going to go out to the outer planets, you're still going to require, beyond Jupiter, you're going to require the plutonium generators. Back to you, Dick.
When it comes to the potential for failure of having to deploy a whole lot of solar panels on Juno versus not having to deploy because you've got a nuclear power supply on board, I would think the reliability of the nuclear would be higher. But I guess there's cost and people's protests and a whole lot of other things involved. Anyone else with any further questions or comments on the subject of space that Paul has been covering, give me your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
GB.
VHYYY.
We got John and Joe in that order. Go ahead, John.
Just a point of information. I think Juno was the mother of Cassiopeia. That's where that came from.
Okay, good to know. Joe, RYY, K2RIW.
Okay, the question is, these spacecrafts that are designed like 30-something years ago, like Voyager 1, Voyager 2, and these things are way, way out there. Did they design these things with the thought in mind of having a way of reading what you would call, for simplicity, RSSI, Receive Signal Strength Indicator, to know how it's receiving you from Earth to this device? Do they have a way of doing that?
Yeah, the telemetry on board is telling you signal strength, battery voltage, temperature, solar wind, telling you all kinds of things. On top of that, it was designed in such a way that as it gets further and further out, and the signal it sees